Evan title, music that was recorded live at Solar Myth in South Philadelphia. WRTI and The Late Set was a part of that very special night in September of 2025 with Mary Halverson's Amaryllis.
I sadly had to miss this gig, so I'm so happy to get a taste here.
You got a little bit. And you know what? So did The Late Set subscribers, because we presented a special track just a couple of days ago.
That's right. Maybe it's in your feed. It's in your feed. Check it out.
Check your feed.
What an incredible band, first of all.
They're amazing. They really are. You know, I characterized it in the conversation as like these couple of cells that are happening sort of simultaneously. And yet there is also this sort of one overall cell that sort of moves, I don't know, like a paramecium or something. It just like, it keeps like moving around in really interesting ways. That's the best way I could describe it, really, because I don't necessarily know what's happening musically, but I'm just fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I said that I missed this Philly gig, but I did just recently have a chance to see this band at Jazzfest Berlin at the Berliner Festspiel. And it was the same personnel playing, I don't know if it was the same set, but it was a lot of the same music. And I was so grateful to have that experience on this tour, because they've really been on the road. I mean, they've been all over, you know, like they managed a pretty lengthy American tour and then a bunch of dates in Europe. And you get that thing from a band that really has a chance to dig in and stretch with a book of material. You know?
Everyone is handling his or her own business, and then the band itself is really impactful.
So my feeling about Amaryllis is that it's just another indication of the growth and the risk-taking that Mary Halverson has done as a composer band leader. You know, she has always, I mean, from the first moment that anyone has heard her, you know, like the first thing you notice is like, wow, that's a very unique sound. Like she has a voice on the guitar that nobody else has. But step by step, she has been just deepening her inquiry as a composer and orchestrator, right?
And all of it comes from her relationship with her instrument.
Yeah, yeah.
Like all of that stuff is coming from her as a composer, from an acoustic, from a guitar, and you know, an open body guitar sound.
Mm-hmm. The music on this album, this most recent album, About Ghosts, which, spoiler alert, will rank pretty high in my top 10 or top whatever list of this year. I think it's an extraordinary album. What strikes me about it and about the band, especially in performance, is there is such a specificity of language and approach and sort of tactics, you know? It is hyper-specific. It is very precise. And yet it is infinitely flexible and surprising at every turn. And this is a quality that I associate with the music of Charles Mingus, with the music of Andrew Hill. This kind of elasticity and like shiftiness and like even woozy unpredictability, you know, you're like, what's happening, right? And yet there's never a moment at which you feel like the band doesn't know what's happening. They are absolutely in control in ways that are like really profound.
Yeah. You definitely have a sense that everyone is handling their business. Mm-hmm. And you know, the thing that I love is, you know, I would also put some of John Zorn's ensembles in that space,
yeah,
you know, where it just has this sort of ability to be a cue in some way from one musician or from one cell to another in the band. And yet, like, nothing gets lost. Like, there's never a misstep. Like, everyone is aware of here's where it's going. And then that particular person has the ability to extend it in some way, mm-hmm, through his or her soloing. It's really impressive.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it has a sort of a beginning or an end, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't feel like at the end that I'm unsatisfied in any way.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I have written about and interviewed Mary on a number of occasions. I profiled her twice for the New York Times, and I devoted the last chapter of my book, Playing Changes. You know, it's basically a profile of her and her peer circle. So I've got a lot of hang time with Mary. But this was your first time. First interview or first conversation?
First conversation I've ever had with her.
That's so cool.
I've been able to admire her from afar.
So before we dig in, because I have not heard this yet, was there anything that surprised you or was there any, you know, sort of big picture takeaway for you from this conversation?
I'm going to let her talk about some of the things. You know, I was impressed most of all from the things she learned from Anthony Braxton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought that was, and maybe that's been said before. I don't follow everything all the time, I have to admit, you know, but I thought that, you know, she's just very thoughtful, you know, like that's enough for me sometimes, you know, to be that talented and that driven and that thoughtful. I could see why any number of musicians want to be in her orbit.
Yeah.
And she writes beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
She really does write beautifully for horns.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a thing, you know, we haven't gotten too deep into the musical weeds yet, but you know, you and I can go there. So I want to bounce something off of you. There is an unusual harmonic situation with this band and with her writing for the band, because there's not a lot of what we consider jazz harmony involved in her compositions.
Right.
She works with, you know, you referred to the language of the guitar, right? She scores what you might call a lot of open tunings. You know, there's a lot of like perfect fourths and perfect fifths in this music. There's hocketing, you know, this sort of medieval technique of multiple voices sort of pinging, like spreading a single line across different parts, right? So the harmony is at once almost ancient, but then also ultra modern, sort of like indie rockish modernity in there as well.
It does have that Charles Mingus Jazz Workshop sound occasionally, mm-hmm. not specifically the sound, but just sort of
the feeling. Yeah.
Yeah. The feeling, which can sort of be like on that border between like form and raucous.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's where, if you looked at this on like a VU meter for broadcast, you know, it would be right there, you know, pushing on the red a little bit.
Right.
You know, and occasionally bouncing back and forth. And that sort of inherent tension you can understand as a listener without having to really go deep and understand the actual music that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do kind of hear these other things, yeah, you can absolutely recognize that it's new, but it isn't.
Right.
It comes from a place.
It does. And I think it's important to note as well that she places enormous trust in the members of this group. And one reason she can do so is, first of all, that they all have spent so much time together understanding each other's languages. But also, every member of this band is an incredibly accomplished composer and band leader in their own right.
Yeah. I mean, I love almost everyone's records that was on that stage, you know? I mean, I remember years ago listening to the Atheist Gospel Trombone record of Jacob Garchik, and I thought, this guy's brilliant, you know? And then I met him and talked to him, and I was like, he's definitely brilliant, mm-hmm. you know? And he can play the trombone.
He sure can. At Jazz Fest Berlin, this band played first in a three-part concert, and the third part was Patricia Brennan's Breaking Stretch Band, which also features Adam O'Farrell.
Right.
And so two members of the Mary Halvorsen band were then, you know, in Patricia's band. Very different sound, but not unrelated sound, you know? And so it was like they're speaking to each other. And obviously Patricia is the key there. But it was really cool to get both of those tastes on the same concert bill because you just hear, oh, this is what happens when there's a different compositional vision, a different leader utilizing the same kinds of tools, you know?
Yeah. Any one of those musicians is a tremendous artist. Yeah, it's great to hear six of them together.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a bit of Evan Tidal live from Solar Myth, and then we'll join you on stage there with Mary.
Sounds good. How's everyone doing tonight? Please welcome to the late set, Mary Halverson.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, About Ghost is not just a sextet. It's actually two additional saxophonists who joined the proceedings on four of these songs. And I listen to this and I think it forces me to listen to you more as an orchestrator in this situation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, when you have a band for a long time, sometimes it's interesting to think like, and I guess I think this way a lot, but like, what would happen if I added this or added that? And it's easier for me to do that with an existing band because you have a strong foundation and there's a lot of trust and rapport among the band members and you already have a group sound. So it almost feels like this stable foundation and then you can throw a wrench in it and see what's going to happen. So yeah, it was just one day I was sitting down to write some music and I was like, I want to add saxophones. And it was just the thought popped into my head and then I couldn't get it out of my head. So I sat down and the first piece I wrote for the octet configuration is actually the first piece on the record. I hadn't written for saxophones for a while. I guess I had an octet project, which I don't remember what year I released it, maybe 2016 or something like that. But I also had four horns and I really loved writing for four horns. So I think I was missing that a little bit. So I thought adding two saxophones to this could be interesting. And yeah, I ended up really enjoying the whole process.
When you started working with this octet, which I know is some different instrumentation from the previous octet record that mm-hmm. you're talking about, what sort of harmonic challenges did that present to you as a composer? I mean, what are some of the things that you recognized as, like, this is a new space for me, and, you know, how do I connect the thing that I'm hearing with the notes that I'm writing for these musicians?
I think what more horns gives me is just the option for more layering. So it's, you can just build a ton of harmonies. And I often write that way. I'll start with like a guitar part, which will be kind of linear, you know, going along. And then I'll say like, oh, I'm going to add a trumpet line. And then, oh, I'll add a alto sax line. So I kind of layer things in. And that can be a lot of fun. What I have to watch out for is that I tend to write too densely. So then I have to be like, all right, let me chill out a little bit and have a section where maybe it's just three or four of the musicians. So I feel like writing for a larger group to me is a process of trying to balance it. So, you know, you might have moments where it's really dense, but also moments where certain instruments are kind of coming through, or there might be like a little less clutter, moments where it's more open. But I really enjoy writing for larger groups. And yeah, I think that's a part of it is just to try to find the balance in the whole thing.
Even among this number of musicians, as I listen to About Ghosts, I sometimes hear certain cells within the band. It's pretty obvious, for instance, when you're writing a fanfare for the horns. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. I feel like drum and bass also is its own kind of team. Mm-hmm. And then there's guitar with vibes. And those two instruments also interact with the rhythm section. And there's this push-pull that I don't really know because I'm not a musician as a mm-hmm. listener, but I feel like that's it. That's the cells that kind of interact. How can you explain this to someone who, you know, a layperson, that how does this band work?
Right. I mean, it is kind of like that. You almost have different sections of the band. So I might have like a horn fanfare, as you say. But then what I try to do also is break that up. So you'll see in some of the newer music, there might be parts where guitar and trumpet have a melody together, or vibes and trombone have a melody, or maybe the bass has the melody. So again, it's always balance, like trying to, you do have tendencies to write for like a section, or to think of bass and drums as like the rhythm section. But as much as I can break that stuff up so it's less predictable, I try to do it. So when I'm writing pieces, I'll kind of step back and be like, what's missing from this book of music? Like, and tempos as another example, it's like, you'll notice what your tendencies are. Wow, everything's kind of like 60 BPM or like 100 BPM. Like, I'm going to write something really fast. I'm going to write something, you know, so trying to find these like balance points, or maybe there needs to be like a rubato thing or something for a release. So yeah, I think it's the same thing within the group. You kind of start with a more traditional thing and then try to break it up a little bit.
I know via your association at Wesleyan that you studied and were inspired by Anthony Braxton. And I wondered if one of the ghosts here is sort of the ghost trance music method that he uses. Does that make its way into how this band is organized?
You know, it's so funny that you said that, because people keep asking me what about ghosts is, and like, I keep kind of adding things.
Did I just add one?
It's not supposed to be about like one thing. You know, I like things that have multiple meanings. That literally never occurred to me, ghost trance. Like, but probably it was in the back of my head somewhere, you know. But I would say, if that's a nod to Anthony that I didn't realize, then I'm all for it.
Sure. I mean, sometimes there's parts of this music where those melodies get extended in that similar fashion, mm-hmm. and they don't really resolve always.
Right, right.
And they just kind of have some cyclical movement mm-hmm. that continues. That's why I sort of thought about it in that way.
Yeah, and it's funny because there's other things in ghost trance music. I mean, this music is probably very different than that, but there's little things that Anthony will use in that music. Like, he uses a lot of grace notes. You know, it'll be like, ba, 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 da, ba, da, da. He'll do these little grace notes into the notes, and he'll build that into the lines. And that's also something I've done a little bit in this band. I think it's structured very differently, but I mean, he is the reason I play music and one of my biggest influences. One of the things he always told us was, you know, don't copy what I'm doing. Find your own thing. Go your own way. He always said, if you're not making mistakes, something's wrong. He encouraged all of us, his students, to be take influence from anything and everything. Like, nothing was, he didn't judge music in that way. It wasn't like, oh, country music sucks. You know, he'd never say something like that. So I think that's part of what I took inspiration from, was this idea of like, anything goes, and just creativity. So anything goes, you can do whatever you want. So that being said, I did try always not to copy what he was doing, but instead to try to learn it, absorb it. And then, you know, if something seeps in, of course it does, because it's natural. But I like to think of it as more of like an indirect influence. But the way I look at music, the way I view music and creativity, is 100% from his line of thinking.
Some of his Arista recordings, I mean, had over 100 musicians. Do you ever sort of kind of have a certain ambition to kind of get to that number? I mean, can you hear music for possibly that many people at some point coming from you?
You know, I never have. It's not to say that I won't, but I've never had that desire to do like, you know, a piece for three orchestras or something like that. But I also tend to not think very far ahead. I just think like, what do I want to do next year? You know, what do I want to do now? So it's possible, but no, I think, you know, the biggest group I've ever done, I think, was 10 people. And you know, it's a lot. So I haven't thought too much about going beyond that, but that's not to say it wouldn't happen.
I'm sure it's hard enough just to travel with six.
Oh my God. I mean, that's why I don't have the octet. You know, it would have been nice to take the full octet, but yeah, I mean, it's crazy. You know, even traveling with six people can be crazy, especially when you have a upright bass and a vibraphone.
Thank you. guest is Mary Halverson here on The Late Set. We are live on stage at Solar Myth and with our partners Ars Nova Workshop, where Amaryllis is expected to play a sold-out concert tonight. That must be gratifying, knowing that when you go places, you know, you're playing to a full house. A lot of people like come and want to hear this music, you know, whether it's to figure it out or just to kind of be washed in it.
Yeah, I mean, I never expect it, but I'm always grateful for it. You know, I think when I started playing music, especially music that was more left of center, I never expected to succeed, and I never expected to have really much of an audience for it. So I think like when that does happen, I'm very grateful for it because it's, you know, it is, it's challenging music at times to listen to, and it means a lot that people would be open to checking it out.
I've always been impressed, you know, when you first sort of came into the scene, I think a lot of people, you know, had turned their heads and, you know, kind of figuring out what this is, you know, and at the same time, I was appreciative of the fact that you used the hollow body guitar and that you sort of used that as a foundation of your sound. And, you know, just from having heard so many great, you know, guitarists in the jazz tradition sort of build from that sound. And then to hear you talk about Johnny Smith mm-hmm. and to even play music associated with him. I've always just thought because of that, you know, there is something inherently jazz about where, you know, your origination is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I studied jazz. That was really the first music I fell in love with and kind of did a deep dive into. So that influence is definitely there. And I think what I was drawn to initially was the acoustic sound of the guitar. So now, even though I have all these pedals and I'm playing electric, I mean, I've always played electric guitar, but like using it in more of a manner that involves, you know, distortion and delays and messing things up, I still like to hear that acoustic tone of the instrument, which is why you'll see tonight I have a mic on the body of the guitar as well. So you can kind of hear the duality of the acoustic sound of the instrument because I have a beautiful sounding guitar, which I love, which is a Guild Artist Award. And then also part of the fun is of electric guitar is pedals. So you're taking that pure sound and then kind of messing with it. So I enjoy having both of those elements present.
This is the same guitar that your instructor basically said, this is the one for you.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it stuck.
It stuck. I've had that guitar since the year 2000.
What about it when you played it said, yeah, this is my sound. This is for me.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I just remember I was looking for a hollow body. I had like a semi-hollow body, kind of a, like a lousy semi-hollow body guitar through high school and part of college. And I had told my teacher, Tony Lombardozzi, that I was looking for a guitar. And he was like, I know the perfect guitar for you, and it's for sale at a shop in New Jersey. I was in school at Connecticut. So I drove to New Jersey. I played it once, and that was it. So I don't know what it was. I think it has such a big sound, and it has, I mean, it's a very large-scale guitar. Like, it has this freakishly large headstock, and I think I liked just how powerful it was and that the acoustic sound was so beautiful.
Yeah, it really feels powerful, like especially when you're soloing at times. There were moments on About Ghosts where, well, on the title track, I feel like I can hear it almost in that unadorned sound that you were talking about. There are moments
right.
where I feel like, oh, there it is before the manipulation. Mm-hmm. But even when, you know, like you're playing these wonderful lines, you know, you're incorporating electronics and stuff and I ask myself as a listener, when you use the electronics, are you thinking about that stuff as a note value, or are you thinking about it as a disruptor or as a sculptural element or all of the above at different times? Kind of what is the thought process?
I guess I think of them as ornamentations
yeah.
or just like a little extra thing that you kind of integrate. But I would also like to think that if all my pedals failed in the middle of a gig, which they sometimes do, that I could still play the gig.
Yeah, that's key.
And, you know, that has happened. And it's funny because sometimes, I mean, it also depends on what band I'm playing in. In some bands, I probably more heavily use the pedals for whatever reason. But yeah, I kind of think of them as something extra.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard both you and Bill Frisell do this. I mean, Bill does it beautifully in his own way. And I was just wondering, you know, like, what was the specific thing that you think about when you add that material to it, when you do add the ornamentation, you know? What is it that you're trying to kind of do for the music?
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to morph the sound a little bit or transform it somehow, or get it out of a box of just a clean, kind of clear tone. But the word I always come back to is balance. And I think it's the same thing, like talking about orchestration, how you try to find balance within an orchestration. I think it's the same thing for me with the actual sound of the guitar. Because sometimes I'll consider too, like, am I overusing the pedals? I don't want to overuse them because then it's almost too much. And I like to have the acoustic sound also stand on its own. So I guess I'm thinking about like adding little ornaments or flourishes if it seems like it's good in the moment. Or maybe sometimes you want it to overpower things. That would be also a choice.
Yeah.
But that's another thing with pedals. I think I feel I only have a few of them and I haven't really changed my pedal setup very much in the past 25 years, because I really like to have full control over them. Yeah. You know, so if I press a button, I know exactly what it's going to do. And I want to be able to manipulate it in a way that even if it sounds totally crazy, it's actually quite controlled, or at least I'm thinking about it that way.
I remember years ago when I broadcast Kurt Rosenwinkel at the Village Vanguard, and he put his pedal board out during the sound check. And he had, 15 or so pedals. And then he looked at me, said, all of this just to make it sound like a guitar.
I love it. That's great.
I talked earlier about sort of groupings within the sextet here, and I did mention sort of, at least I feel, a special relationship between you and Patricia Brennan, the vibraphonist. There are times where, you know, you're both sort of electronic instruments in some way, and so there are interactions that feel that they are timbral in some way that feel really special. I mean, the attack is obviously very different between what she's doing and the way you're playing a guitar, mostly. But timbrally, it seems to, there's a unique combination within the band. Is that something that you worked on, that you hear, that you...
I mean, it's something I thought about when I decided to have vibraphone and specifically Patricia in the group. I think there is a really nice sensibility between the two instruments. Like she does a lot of vibrato and like manipulating the speed of her vibrato. And I'm doing like a lot of custom vibrato with my foot on the volume pedal. And we do a lot of like comping. We do a lot of it together. Like, we're not really worried about getting in each other's way, and we don't really talk about it. We just do it. So I think also I feel very connected to her just in terms of creatively, like what we're into and what we try to make happen. But it's, I like having another harmonic instrument. And I did a band with pedal steel guitar, and I've worked a lot with pianists, and I've worked a lot with other guitarists. This is my first band with a vibraphonist. But I think it's nice, you know, there's always, people always think like you're getting in each other's way, or, you know, when like I teach at the new school and you'll have an ensemble and there'll be like two guitarists and a pianist and everyone seems kind of dejected. And it's like, no, it's not a bad thing. Like you can work with it. You just have to find creative ways to do it. And I think it's really nice. It allows for like a lot of variety. Like there could be moments where it's really dense with both of us, maybe let's say comping behind a trombone solo, or there could be moments when neither of us are playing or just one of us, or maybe a combination. So I think I really like all the possibilities that it allows for.
Talk to us, if you would, about the unique contributions of both the trombonist Jacob Garchik and Adam O'Farrell on trumpet.
Yeah, I mean, they're both, everybody in this group is some of my favorite musicians, and I feel very lucky to have them in my band and honestly, just to be able to get them all together at the same time and place, logistically. But Jacob, I would say Jacob and Toma are the musicians I've been working with the longest. I think I've been working with Toma since 2004 and Jacob since probably 2007. And Jacob has played in a couple other bands of mine as well. But first of all, I love the trombone. I feel like the trombone gets a bad rap sometimes. I don't know why.
Sure.
But I think it's such a beautiful instrument, and particularly Jacob's sound, I think is just so beautiful. And he's incredibly musical, can kind of like hear anything, play anything. So he's always been one of my favorite people to work with. Also, everyone in this band is just a super cool person, which helps,
you know,
when you have a tour. And you have to hang out with these people and you actually enjoy hanging out with everybody. That counts for a lot. And Adam, he's quite a bit younger than I am. And I think I heard him play. I mean, he must have been like in his early 20s when I first heard him. I mean, he's been playing gigs since he was a teenager. But I remember hearing him play a gig at Cornelia Street Cafe in New York when he was very young, and just being blown away by the maturity of his playing. Like, you know, he can play anything. It's like the trumpet is just like a little toy. You know, he can do whatever he wants, but it's this thoughtfulness and maturity. And like, he's a very like searching, patient player. And so I think that's what drew me to his sound and to working with him, and also a great person as well.
So I understand that you're writing a lot more music for this group.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about some of it, including something we may hear tonight.
Yeah, exactly. So we are playing some music from About Ghosts. Everything we're going to play tonight is either on About Ghosts or it's new. I'm going to put an asterisk behind new, and I'll explain that in a second. But I think one of the things that's cool about this band, you know, now that we've done 3 records and have new material on top of that, is you can like do a couple sets without repeating anything. So, you know, in Boston, we did 2 sets and each set was like 75 minutes long and we didn't repeat anything. So I think it makes it more interesting, especially if you're doing a tour where you don't have to play the same set every night. And I really enjoy that. So I wanted to have some new material for this tour. One of the pieces, the one called Florid Waning, that piece is totally new, written for this band. And then there's 4 other pieces, which are sort of new, but... So I mentioned earlier my octet, but I had an octet with the pedal steel guitarist, Susan Alcorn, mm-hmm. who sadly passed away in January, kind of unexpectedly, which was just a huge loss. I mean, she was an incredible musician, human being. But I had a group with her and we recorded an album, and then I wrote kind of half a record and we performed the pieces a few times, but then I don't know what happened. Everyone got busy and we all did something else and we never recorded that music, but I really liked the pieces. And I kind of always thought I'll write the other half of the record someday and maybe record those pieces. And then she died. And then I realized, you know, I'm not going to replace her in that group, or I'm not going to play the pieces without her. It wouldn't feel right. So I thought maybe I'll try to rearrange some of them for this group almost as like a tribute to her. So there's 4 pieces we're going to perform tonight, which I had originally performed with her in my octet, which never got recorded. Jacob was in that group as well. He's the only musician who's overlapping between those 2 bands. And that was kind of an interesting process for me, because usually when I'm arranging, I'll be like adding someone, like I was saying before, let's add saxophones or whatever. But this was a process of reduction, because it was 4 an octet and now it's a sextet. So I had to almost reduce these pieces down to work for 6 people instead of 8. And I've never done something like that before. So it was, and I changed them a little, you know, but they're basically the same pieces.
Hence the asterisk. Is that what you
were
saying?
Yes, exactly. So they're not new, but you know, nobody's really ever heard them and they're basically new.
It was in 2019 that you won the MacArthur, is that correct? So I know when something like that happens, you know, it's like this huge sort of punctuation mark in an artistic career. It allows so much exploration. And it sort of happened also at the same time that all the other possibilities began to shut down.
Yep.
So I understand that while you probably did work a lot on your music, that you got really good at another hobby related to intoxicology. Is that something that you did during the pandemic?
You mean I became an amateur mixologist?
Yes, mixologist, yeah.
But I also balanced it with productive hobbies, like I started doing a lot of yoga.
Excellent. Again, the balance, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, what was a drink that you were particularly proud of making? Give us a recipe, Mary.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I have a lot of innovative recipes. Like most of them, I was just like trying to figure out, because I missed going to cocktail bars. So I thought, like, how can I do that at home? So I have this little, I mean, it's hilarious. It's just like a corner of it's like a little corner near the kitchen, which just is stacked up with like bottles. I've got about 20 different kinds of bitters and, you know, various things. But I spent a while just trying to perfect an old fashioned. So, you know, playing around with different recipes and things like that. But I'm not really trying to innovate as much, just making good cocktails. So I make all kinds of martinis and Negronis and old fashions, Manhattans.
Do you do the Boulevardier, which is
I have made a
modified Negroni?
Yes, that's very good. I make a gin cocktail called a Hanky Panky, which is, I get these recipes. I make penicillins. I found that recipe online.
Right.
You know, sometimes I'll tweak them a little bit, but for the most part, they're pretty straight ahead.
A friend of mine who is in that industry and worked for like Lydia Bastianic and Mario Batali, et cetera, he took me to this place on East 6th Street called Amor y Amargo. Have you ever heard of that place?
No, I have not.
The first time I went in there, they had probably 100 different bitters. It was like walking into what felt like an apothecary.
That's so cool.
You know, and there wasn't a bad drink the entire night. And there may have been a few too many. But yeah, it's just, I don't even know if it's still open because I've left New York since, but Amor y Amargo.
Okay, I have to look because I didn't know about that. Yeah. There are some great cocktail bars in New York.
You're making your own bitters too?
No, that's going to be, I guess that's the next level. I was about to make a really dark joke and say that's for the next pandemic, but maybe that's not good.
Some people say we're in a pandemic, not...
For real.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for your time, for joining us here on The Late Set, and I look forward to hearing this music. It really is a unique experience when you're able to witness it in person. I love listening to the recordings too, but it's always special when you go, oh, this is what it feels like when it's live. I really feel like this band has a certain power that, you know, that is even more special when you're able to kind of see it, hear it, and feel it at the same time.
Thank you. You know, I agree. I mean, there's something about a live gig that's just special that's going to be different than a recording. For me, a recording is like perfecting the tunes. Like, how can I try to make a perfect little version, often more succinct version of a tune? But when you hear it live, you know, the tunes are much longer. You know, people really go for it. And try to feed off that energy. So yeah, it is a very different thing. All
right. Mary Halverson, thank you for joining us on The Late Set.
Thanks for having me.
I hate when I miss a good hang, Josh, so I'm really grateful for this recording.
You missed a good hang, Nate.
Two of my favorite people and you missed, hanging out at one of my favorite spots.
You missed an opportunity where we went even deeper near the bar talking about cocktails.
You're not supposed to say that.
I mean, you know, I didn't say that we were imbibing in any way.
But yeah, love Mary, love her music, and what a great conversation. And speaking of... digging things, it's time
for This I Dig. I'll go first. I am
digging Lewis Porter's Substack.
Aha. There you go.
This is hilarious because, I mean, I love Lewis. One of the foremost knowledgeable people about this music.
You've got to name it. What is it called?
It's called Playback.
Playback. Lewis Porter.
Playback with Lewis Porter. And he currently has posted a show with Sonny Rollins. That's sort of mind-blowing. They do an incredible version of Olio, and it is Sonny Rollins with Jim Hall, Bob Cranshaw, and Walter Perkins.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in 1961. And I'm just going to leave it there because there's a lot you can learn from Lewis Porter. You will learn a lot about this particular era in Sonny's life and things that you would also come to discover in Aidan's book as well. I'm just telling you, there's about 30 minutes of really tremendous Sonny Rollins audio that was very well recorded by Nesui Erdogan.
Mm.
And never became part of Atlantic, and then moved over to another label. You'll hear all about the story when you read the Substack Playback from Lewis Porter.
When I was working at another radio station in this greater New York area, I edited Lewis Porter's jazz history series called Deep Dive, and it was such a treat to, you know, just join him on these journeys into jazz lore, into the historical record, a lot of like debunking conventional wisdom. And it was so fun. And it was we really got into it, you know, and I'm extremely proud. And I can say this, to you, because I think you'll appreciate it as much as I do. Every time I see Lewis and he introduces me to somebody, he says, "Oh, this is the best editor I ever had."
There you go.
And so I wear that with pride because Lewis is one of the greatest jazz historians that we have.
He's tremendous. And having been in his inner sanctum at his house
once,
I can tell you, you know, like Jocko said, it ain't bragging if you can back it up. And this man had the scholarly research all around him.
Oh, yeah.
Not to mention the largest African gray parrot I had ever seen.
Really?
I can't remember the name of this bird. Lewis, if you listen to the late set, you got to tell me the name of that bird.
Wow. I didn't know about the bird.
He had a very large gray African parrot.
And did the parrot know how to, you know, speak in like Lester Young slang or something?
I'm telling you, that was parrot.
Did the parrot tell you about the Vaunts?
That parrot probably was the hippest bird. Like, because I know that Lewis only played the best stuff for that bird.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I am also going to endorse, you know, a piece of media related to music, and this is a podcast. So if you like the late set, I'm pretty sure you will like this show as well. Make sure you listen to our show first.
That's right.
But this is called Fela Kuti, Fear No Man.
Ah,
and
yes.
This is an Audible original produced by Higher Ground Studios, which is the Obamas' media shop.
Right.
It's hosted by Jad Abumrad.
Yep.
Who
from Radio Lab.
A lot of people will know from Radio Lab.
Yep.
And it is a series that basically introduces folks to the story of Fela Kuti, but, you know, not just the music, right? It's about how he came to be, like, you know, what was his musical formation? What was his political formation, you know?
And so, art in those circumstances in Nigeria at the time, post-independence.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a show very much about the sort of post-colonial Nigerian situation, all of the horrors and the tensions, and then the sort of reclamation. I have only listened at this point to the first two episodes of this show, but in each of them, I have learned a lot. Like, you know, the research here is on the Lewis Porter level. It is extremely well sound designed. It's a, you know, beautifully made show. And so if you enjoy the stories behind the music, this is one that I highly recommend.
Fela.
That episode two talks about, you know, this club that he used to go to, you know, in London, because he was, you know, a student at Trinity Conservatory in London. And there was a club that he went to all the time in 1960. And, you know, they say that he saw, you know, they're not certain, but they know who came through that club at that time. And it was like, you know, Miles and Ella and Ellington and, you know, it's just like 1960, right? So pretty much everybody.
The good stuff.
Yeah.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. It's hosted by Nate Chenin and myself, Josh Jackson. Our show is produced by Alex Arif. The interview was recorded live at Solar Myth, presented by Ars Nova Workshop. The house engineer was Richard Ryan. Special thanks to Mark Chrisman and the folks at Nonesuch Records.
Do you enjoy this podcast? We know you do. Leave us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice. Also, be sure to subscribe and follow us on all social media. Also, we are proud to announce the Late Set Radio Hour. This is a modified version of our podcast, repackaged for the air and hosted by WRTI's own evening jazz host, Nicole Sweeney. Our next episode airs on Sunday, November 23rd, and will feature music and words by the NEA jazz master, alto saxophonist, and composer bandleader, Gary Bartz.
And on the next episode of this podcast, it's a listening party. We're unboxing and spinning music from some of the best jazz releases and stocking stuffers for the holidays. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager, and he mixed this episode. God bless him. Our production assistants are Alexander Bollacher, Tyler Deerfield, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran. Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate General Manager for Content and Programming is Josh Jackson. C'est moi, d'état. And Bill Johnson is WRTI's General Manager.
Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we've got happening in Philadelphia and beyond. We'll see you soon.